Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, January 20, 2025. My name is Magnus Thiewald, and joining me in the studio today are
Peter R.H.
and Stephen Fadd.
And we have a good show for you lined up today. We're going to start off talking about some of the stuff going on in connection to the inauguration down in the United States and the transfer of power there and all the things that have been dominating the news cycle here in Canada as well related to that. We also have a report from Danny Nesvaradani. A couple of reports from Danny. One about the SF Perg Radical Book Fair and also the effect of road salt on Burnaby's Stony Creek. And a project to deal with that. So those are coming up in just a little while. Of course, we have Bird Note. And at the end of the show, we'll be talking a bit more about tariffs and the history of ups and downs in the world of tariffs. So we'll be talking about that as well. All right, down in it is today. Inauguration down in the United States. Donald Trump is, just shortly, a little while ago, was officially inaugurated as the 47th president of the United States. Lots of developments happening around that. One of the biggest ones for Canada is that there's reporting that the much talked about tariffs, as much as 25%, tariffs on Canadian goods, as well as some other tariffs he was talking about, will not be issued today via an executive order. The reporting is that instead he'll be ordering a study of what those tariffs might be.
A white ribbon commission. you know, like, it's just amazing. You know, like, my background is in economics.
Yeah.
And I've always taken the tariff talk the same way I've taken his build the wall talk in his first term, mm-hmm. which is, it's kind of an aspirational goal, right? Like, it's, Trump is not, in my view, the kind of person who's going to stick by a measure or a goal in the face of adversity with no payoffs and a lot of headaches and hardships. And build the wall and tariffs are basically two pieces of the same pot in the sense that there is absolutely no potential payoff and he's going to get a billion headaches. Mm-hmm. It's not one of these things where he's going to be able to score an easy win, like like unbanning TikTok or whatever it is. It's just one of the things where, like, he's already renegotiated trade with Canada via USMCA, which is the update of NAFTA that was originally signed in 1994 and then updated in Trump's first term. And the thing about USMCA actually was, it was universally agreed, actually, that it was an improvement on the original agreement. It's unbelievable because it happened during Trump's first term, but it was actually materially regarded as a slight improvement on the original. And how would it possibly differ materially in his second term such that you would get an improvement on that? It seems improbable.
Although it didn't seem like his proposed policy around this, the introduction of tariffs, which he's talked about, not just in the context of Canada, but also in the context of China, and then other ones, you know, 10% tariffs across all imports.
What?
It didn't, you know, back in the last administration when they renegotiated NAFTA, you know, he came forward with his complaints, and you know, in the end, all three countries engaged.
Incoherent as they might be.
And this time, you know, it didn't seem to be about, you know, an improvement to the free trade agreement. It was much more presented as an America first policy.
I think his exact phrasing, and I quote, is that tariffs is the most beautiful word in the English language. And while I might not be in complete disagreement with Mr. Trump, I can understand the sentiment. And I think so. Here's the challenge. Let's start with China, because you mentioned China. China is what we call a producer surplus. So it is capable right now, at this particular moment in time, of producing many more goods and services than its domestic market is capable of absorbing.
Yeah.
So in a sense, and I was talking with an economist friend of mine at Bloomberg, he does quant stuff for Bloomberg, you know, China basically is exporting deflation. And normally this sounds scary and bad, but remember, North American economy, macroeconomy, has been in an inflationary spiral for the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Deflation is more or less exactly what we want. So it's right up our alley.
So what do you mean by exporting deflation? What's the mechanism there?
So I was recently in Vegas for the CES Tech Expo. Perfect example of this is something, you know, that used to cost $20,000, like a medical device in hospitals.
Right.
China makes it for $200. And this doesn't necessarily mean invasion of intellectual property. It just means they make it cheaper via a different method, whatever.
But that's also a common sort of development with a lot of tech stuff. You know, it's very expensive when it's first introduced. And as the technology matures, it comes down in price to the point where, you know, the phone we have in our pocket is, you know, more powerful, you know, for under $1,000 is more powerful than a room full of 1970s computers.
Yeah, but my favorite example of this is actually something that's happened very recently. It happened in 2024, which is tunnel boring machines. Mm-hmm. So tunnel boring machines is the thing you build subways with.
Yeah.
So typically, they're imported from Germany, and they cost around $100 million each. And China recently figured out the technology to do it for basically 1/7 mm-hmm. of the price. Now, the Chinese one is basically identical, right? Yeah. There's basically no IP on this thing because it's just mostly about mechanical complexity. It's hard to figure out. China figured out, has it for cheaper. It's going to be cheaper to build subways going forward.
Yeah.
But I think, look, Trump wants to do, let's say, 20% tariffs, 25% tariffs. I think the picture people have of how these tariffs are going to play out is that stuff is going to get more expensive at Walmart. But that's not necessarily the most important or meaningful way in which it is going to play out. Because the way tariffs hit the most is actually on intermediate inputs. So stuff that, you know, like half-finished or parts that you put into a factory or like industrial.
The components of
yeah.
Like, finished projects that are assembled.
Or your ice cream machine at McDonald's that breaks down all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff like that, that's going to start feeding into your costs. And that's kind of an exponential kind of a spiral, right? Because mm-hmm. like every step of the way, there's 25%.
Yeah.
And it just starts to get very, very uncomfortable rather fast. Because 25% of a $10 toy at Walmart is not great, but tolerable. But if you have something that's going to be 25% each step of the way, and there's like five different steps, it's basically tripled in price
right.
overnight. And it's just that stuff like that, I think, is because there's the way the global trading economy works.
Right? I was just going to say, and that mechanism would have been a huge complication within the auto industry, in which, you know, parts and components move back and forth across the border numerous times through the process of manufacturing any vehicle.
Absolutely. And this is kind of dovetails with kind of Trump's aims, or I shouldn't say aims, his aims, quote unquote, because I don't know if he has a coherent ideology around this, is that the modern industrial economy is built on this seamless integration of supply chains. And that means, no, there's a common kind of meme on the internet. It's a leftist meme about how you have a batch of peaches that are harvested in, you know, like Argentina or Chile or whatever, and then is packed in Thailand and then sold all the way back in North America. And, you know, this is usually depicted as very wasteful. But it's actually not the case because it's done by ocean transport, and both the carbon pollution cost of ocean transport and just the general economic cost is exceedingly low. And you can imagine, obviously, this is obviously much more the case for the auto industry, where parts and engines and stuff like that pass back and forth across the border all the time in order to make a finished product. And, you know, like, yeah, this is going to be very disruptive, but it's not going to be disruptive that's going to be, in a way, that's going to be credit to Mr. Trump. Because these things are hard to replace in terms of the ecosystem, in terms of supply chain, overnight, but in the meantime, you get huge layoffs, huge disruptions, huge supply shortages. You're not seeing any of the benefits, but you're seeing a lot of the costs. So that's where I'm at mentally. I just can't imagine how it would benefit him for him to go through with this.
I would like to just, I didn't want to interrupt you, but as far as mainland China goes, is the reason for the low cost advancement of technology, or is it what?
Low cost labor.
Okay, that's a better term than, I guess, slave labor. But the labor is so low cost. Is that sort of what?
It's like the right way to think about it is that it's a continuum between the two, with the dial shifting gradually, but in recent years very rapidly toward technology and scale. And this is something I've looked into recently in some depth. So when reform and opening started, that's the Chinese term for their market economy, in the 1980s, really took off in the mid-80s, originally it was based on low-cost advantages. And most of the big exporters that set up shop were actually overseas Chinese, like from Thailand or Taiwan or Singapore or Hong Kong. And they set up shop and they would export to Europe, North America, and so forth. And that was originally based purely on low cost. And gradually over time, as China has developed, it develops own industrial chain, and as incomes have risen, China is actually in many ways no longer a low-cost center. And there's very specific figures to illustrate that. The cost of labor in southern China is about three times, actually just in China overall, is about three times that of Vietnam, a fellow communist but kind of market economy country. And there are a lot of industries which have actually been transferred over from China to Vietnam, mostly stuff like textiles and, you know, low-cost toys and stuff like that, where labor cost is a huge component, but industrial capital cost is not.
So you're saying that mainland China has taken the low-cost labor over to other countries?
It's pushed it out, basically, because, and it's very much explicit government policy as well, because in a lot of cities, the government will have, in the last decade, a emissions target. And all these like super high pollution, high labor kind of, but not very high industrial intensivity industries are being pushed out of a lot of Chinese cities.
Well, Stephen, please. The idea of the possible slave labor.
Yeah.
What's your knowledge?
What's my thoughts on that? So there are two different things here. There's kind of the general moniker of slave labor, which kind of like people say, you know, just kind of like, oh, slave labor in the third world. I don't think that's
it's mainland China I'm talking about. Mainland slave labor.
So what really people mean, and when people say these things, are two different things. So in terms of actually what could be reasonably related to the term slave labor, usually it refers to what in China is called Lao Gai. And Lao Gai is a concept, it refers to kind of basically labor camps. And labor camps was originally a setup where prisoners, general prisoners, mostly not really political prisoners, but general prisoners who have been deemed criminals by the state, usually petty crime actually, and they would be sent to labor camps where they would be required to work, they'd be forced to work while they're undergoing their internment. And that could be accurately called slave labor in one sense or another. It's unfree labor. And I don't think that's very, very different from, say, chain gangs in Texas where they're, or prison firefighters in the
but
state.
But you see, Stephen, it could be that, I mean, I'm going with, I'm,
yeah, please,
I'm just getting information.
Yeah.
Like, it, the argument could be made that there is these slave, the labor camps
yeah.
is making use of a lot of labor, and whereas, you know, I mean, there are instances in the United States where it's kind of there, but it's not. It ideally shouldn't exist at all as such, but, I mean, it doesn't exist to the extent it would be in mainland China. See, I don't know what the
information... I see what you're saying.
Yes.
So, but let's get back to the tariffs for a second. I just want to take a moment to let our listeners know that we may be momentarily interrupted.
Yep.
Very briefly in this broadcast, because our techs are here and they have to swap in some equipment, but it's really a matter of... it's happening in another room. We won't see it here in the studio, but it's unplugging something and plugging it back in to insert some equipment into our broadcast chain. So if you see that happening, that's what's going on. So back to the tariffs, though.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think what you've articulated about, you know, why tariffs are bad and why, you know, why for the last 40 years, you know, the business community and others have been pushing... a free trade agenda and working internationally to put in place many free trade agreements. You know, that's what the EU, one of its main components is to free up trade.
Washington, D.C. is pro for free trade. It isn't. There you go.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the NAFTA and, you know, Asian, you know, the Trans-Pacific free trade agreements. You know, so for, you know, 40 years plus, probably really 50 years since the 70s,
yeah.
You know, the strong movement has been to open up in free trade.
Yeah.
And along comes Trump with a completely counter agenda, or rhetoric at least. And as you say, I mean, your position is that probably he's not going to do anything about it. But at the same time, he was a popular, and maybe his whole point was it was a popular campaigning position, right? It sounds good.
So I have a lot of thoughts on this, yeah. but I'm going to be very quick about it.
Well, the one other thought I was going to make, though, is that, you know, one thing, if there's one thing we learned about Trump is that he doesn't seem to care that much for truth, but also, you know, I don't think he necessarily has a deep understanding of these
what
ideas.
Are you talking about? He's the creator of Trump coin. And but you know.
And so, you know, I think, you know, one thing he's shown through his rhetoric is a real love for simple solutions. And of course, you know, the simplest solution and not the best solution to a trade deficit is tariffs. So, you know, at the same time, one thing I've wondered about this whole thing going on, you know, since he started talking about this in the fall, even before the election, and again more recently, is where has been that business community that has been, you know,
formerly opposed to Mr. Trump,
but well, that has been such an advocate of the free trade agenda because, you know, because it benefits them, but also because, you know, it would seem to, in many ways, make a lot of sense in the way that trade works. Where have they been in offering any kind of counter argument,
yeah.
or are they just not want to take on Trump in a war of arguments?
King Trump. No, this is a great series of things. This is something I've thought about a lot, but I'm going to be trying very brief about it. So, in order, first of all, Washington consensus is usually the term that's used for the free trade agenda that's yeah. been pursued across the West for the last 50 years. Number two, I think the Washington consensus in many ways has been politically very successful. Many countries have adopted it, and the growth of East Asian and South Asian economies have been to some extent yeah. attributed to it. Number three, I think Mr. Trump is genuinely and authentically opposed to free trade, but for very incoherent reasons. Yeah. And I think he is a person in many ways of the 80s. And the story of the 80s is the steel mill towns shutting down,
yeah.
of American jobs being moved to Mexico, all these things that are happening that's perceived as being resulting from free trade. Yeah. And so he attributes blame to free trade. Number four, But he is not alone or unique in this. Trump was president from 2017 to 2020. You know what I mean? And then he was followed by 4 years of Biden, which just ended now. And Biden was not a free trader, right? Biden, when he was elected in 2020, was all about restoration, was about institutions. But yes. One particular restoration, one particular institution, he was not interested in was free trade. Mm-hmm. And Biden, in many ways, in my view at least, as an economics person, dismantled free trade much more systematically than Trump ever did in his first term. And not necessarily because he appeared more ideologically radical or was saying more radical things, but because, in a sense, paradoxically, because he staffed his administration with many more competent people, but people who were ideologically predisposed to and be against trade. Remember, Trump's first term was staffed mostly by conventional Republicans, yep. And conventional Republicans were, for the most part, pro-trade. He had a trade advisor, a U.S. trade representative in Lighthizer, who was very much ideologically anti-trade. But that was tend to be rare. 90% of his administration were pro-trade, were guys like, yep, Steve Mnuchin, Secretary, yep, of the Treasury, very mainstream Wall Street guy. And I think to the extent that Biden combined both kind of the traditionally anti-trade, anti-free trade views of the labor left within the Democratic Party, as represented by the staffers that all came from the you know, Elizabeth Warren campaigns and Bernie Sanders campaigns, and as well as just general Cold War tendency to view every big other economy as an adversary. It's not just Russia or China or whatever or Iran. Yeah. It's also the fact that he viewed every economic improvement that the European Union made as an economic threat. He vetoed the takeover of the steel mills, yep, by Nippon Steel, American ally, a staunch American ally, yep, despite the fact that the workers at that steel plant were begging for it. And it was insane. And, you know, like, there was no national interest being validated in that circumstance. And so hundreds of American jobs were being lost. And so he was, by the end of his term, he could absolutely make the case that, well, if in his doddering senescence could be said to have any kind of ideology whatsoever, it was in fact anti-trade. Sorry, I'm just going on my anti, you know, my little,
okay,
rant.
Okay, so let's move on from tariffs.
Yeah.
And on to the other thing that happened this morning was two sets of pardons, late pardons issued this morning, just within hours.
I wish I was part of the Biden family so I can get a pardon too.
Two sets of pardons issued this morning by Joe Biden just shortly before the end, his end of his presidency.
Yeah.
The first one preemptively pardoned members of his close family, his brother and his brother's partner and sister-in-law. It was like 5-6 people, all very close Biden relatives. Now, there's no indication that they've done anything wrong.
I don't think they did.
I don't know enough to. I hadn't heard about anything, you know, brewing with them. So, you know, I think for the moment we can take it that they hadn't done anything wrong. And Joe Biden's fear or motivation for doing this was a fear that they were going to be politically and legally harassed by the incoming administration. There's been lots of talk about that stuff. You can see what happened with Hunter Biden, you know, who is by no means a perfect individual.
Model citizen.
Yeah. But clearly got, you know, very extensively, you know, harassed and pursued. You know,
I mean, he got the anal colonoscopy of politics, basically.
Okay. And the second group of preemptive pardons pardoned General Mark Milley, who is the former chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staffs of the United, which is the sort of overall,
the tongue twister,
uniformed leader of the American military. He's the top military commander.
Yeah.
So Mark Milley, Mark Milley, Anthony Fauci, the members of the January 6th committee, any police officers who testified at the January 6th committee and investigation. And again, it was preemptively issued, again, with no indication that any of these people have done anything wrong. And of course, we've all heard the endless rhetoric, for instance, against Anthony Fauci, you know, and the threats from serious and not so serious, you know, about whether, you know, that he should be prosecuted for many reasons. So again, you know, as with the the pardons of his family members, you know, I understand his motivations and reasons, and, you know, on a certain level, it is probably good to protect all those people from, you know, partisan inspired sort of harassment legal stuff coming up. But at the same time, the idea of preemptive pardons seems very scary.
I would say it brings to head the legal anachronism of the U.S. president having full and unlimited pardon powers, which is like a very 18th century concept. That's the main thing that comes to my mind. I think the pardon for Dr. Fauci is very much justified, because the way the whole COVID vaccine thing has been emotionalized, I think he is in many ways in genuine personal danger, and I could definitely see, as long as he's willing to accept that pardon, and if the pardon has been issued, then he is clearly willing to accept it. I think that's up to him. And same to some extent goes for General Milley, who was kind of involved in the crux of the whole response to January 6th. Yep. I think even the pardons for the January 6th committee, I think, is less than ideal. I think if you are in Congress taking on these public political positions, you have to be willing to take on the legal risk. Like, it's just part of the bargain. Like, you're being elected to Congress. This is how this thing works. I don't think, you know, it's wrong to accept these pardons. I think it's less than ideal. I think then you get to the point where you talk about his family, and it's just like, just doesn't look good.
One of the things that concerns me about it is just the precedent it set. I mean, there's already a perception, I think, among many people in the United States and elsewhere that, you know, a lot of people of great privilege operate above the law. And that seemed to be the case with Donald Trump himself, where, you know, all these different, you know, different charges, whether it was the documents that he kept, whether it was the enticement to insurrection, all of which seemed to be legally supported. You know, they all just kind of evaporated in the political space. And so many other examples of where it already seems that there's always this real reluctance to, particularly I think in Washington, in the American system, to hold people to account. I think partly motivated, you know, they don't want to hold people to account because that means they might once be held to account. So one of my concerns about this, though, you know, it feeds into that perception. But okay, so we understand why Biden's doing this, and these people probably deserve to be protected in some fashion from the harassment that may have been coming their way. What happens at the end of say, the Trump administration in 4 years?
Million pardons for all the MAGAs of the world.
Yeah, he's already been set up, you know, by the Supreme Court to be basically immune for any official acts he does during his presidency, anything that can be classed as an official act.
Yeah.
And with this sort of setup, and with this precedent and the way it kind of perhaps will normalize this kind of pardon, you know, anyone who's working for Trump between now and the end of his administration, who is involved in some nefarious business, and
there's going to be a lot.
Yeah, and you look at what happened at January 6th, there's a whole lot of nefarious business there, and they really did, through not just through January 6th itself, but through Trump's direct efforts to try and pressure election officials to provide false information or distorted information, all that kind of stuff. Imagine if everyone who was involved in that process thought, yeah, I can help this. I don't need to worry at all about any legal repercussions because at the end of the term, I'm going to get a preemptive pardon and I'm going to be scot-free. So
it's going to be ironic.
For the whole administration can basically do what it wants.
I mean, to
be
fair,